New.
We offer unique music, talk, and news from around the globe, but without the advertising, gossip, and filler. You trust us to respect your intelligence and curiosity. KPFT works hard to earn your respect.
Your membership allows the creative spirit to flourish. So why wait for a pledge drive to support KPFT?
Give a call to our membership department at 713-526-4000, extension 314. Your pledge of support helps keep this valuable source on the air. This is listener-sponsored, commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.
KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
And we can be relieved of a certain amount of election stuff, just the stuff that we're dealing with in the news. But, you know, it's always there. You can go to my blog post at thinkwingradio.com and all that stuff. There's links, stuff. You can go there.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've all been living through this post-election period when we should be in a transition period, but all the news stories are about how Donald Trump and enablers in the Republican Party are basically stretching out this contesting of an election that they've already gone through the courts and had multiple cases dismissed, some almost literally laughed out of court by the judge. So that has inspired me to do this commentary. At this point, we must acknowledge that what we are seeing is an attempted overthrow of elected government under color of law by Trump and the Republican Party writ large. Next, in 2021, we'll be watching Republicans try to further consolidate minority rule by gerrymandering. Now, minority rule, I'm not the first one to bring this up, but as a reference, in the 2000 election, Al Gore won the popular vote by almost 544,000 votes. So for the first four years of George W. Bush's term, we were under minority rule because of the Electoral College. In 2016, Hillary won the popular vote by almost 2.9 million votes. So from 2016 to 2020, or 2017 to 2020, we had another 4 years of minority rule, but by a bigger minority, or a smaller minority, I might say. In the 2020 election, as of November 21st at about 6 p.m., according to the source I found, with 98% of the vote counted, 98%, Biden is winning by over 6 million votes. So we're now at a point where Trump and the Republican Party writ large, not every individual Republican, essentially, they're not even trying to pretend anymore that, okay, we won by the rules. You may not like the rules, but we won. Now they're just saying, if we lose, it's a fraud. If we win, it's legitimate. So Donald Trump, with the active or acquiescent assistance of the Republican Party, is now trying to overturn a decisive victory by Joe Biden, 51% of the vote, which actually is pretty unusual. We've been getting presidents with plurality wins. This is actually a relatively unusual majority win, 51% of the vote. with a near-record turnout of 66.5%. We're no longer in a place of letting the matter work its way through the system. The system has pretty much spoken at this point. The lies and attempted coercion of election officials and other actions of Donald Trump, his minions, his enablers, and apologists now are rising to what, in normal times, in any other country, the United States would call an attempted coup d'etat and a perversion of a legitimate election. The Republican Party, as represented by various individuals, has so far been passive or actively complicit in this attempted coup, and I'm not the first one to call it that, by Donald Trump. Americans must fight against this attempted overthrow of our elected government by whatever peaceful means may be available to them. Further, Americans must be vocal about insisting on fair election redistricting at all levels of government, from local to federal, because 2021, a majority of state legislatures are controlled by Republicans. So it's going to take a lot of public outcry to try to get them to deal fair and square in the redistricting. The alternative is continuation and further entrenchment of minority Republican rule in the United States. So now is the time for all good people to come to the aid of their country in whatever ways they see fit. So that's my commentary for this show. Do you have anything you want to add to that, Andrew?
I want to focus on insisting on fair election districts, because I agree with that. But I think it goes beyond gerrymandering. I think it goes beyond the drawing of you know, single member districts. There is a bill in Congress right now. I'm not sure if it's out of committee yet. H.R. 4000, the Fair Representation Act, which would, if I'm remembering rightly, it would take all of the single member districts in states and consolidate them into larger multi-member districts. So instead of having three districts, each with a certain number of people, each with a single member of Congress or in the House, you would get one district with three representatives covering that all three of those districts' worth of population.
I think we've talked about something like that previously.
We have. But I wanted to bring it back up because, you know, opportunity
well, good
to
point.
Discuss it.
And let me just intercede, since I've already interrupted.
Sure.
The Houston city government actually is the result of, I believe, a Department of Justice consent decree, where we used to have strictly representative districts.
Ah, yes.
And that was considered too prone to gerrymandering and sort of perpetuating a white power structure. So we ended up with a mix of at-large and representative districts.
Right.
So this is not unprecedented, what you're describing.
Right. The Fair Representation Act is sort of a middle ground between having at-large and having, you know, geographical representation, because it's sort of, you know, you still have geographical representation, but it's at-large geographical representation. So, you know, it's that sort of, you know, trying to walk the middle road, have your cake and eat it too. But I think it would still be a much better system than the winner-take-all system we have now, because, you know, there are, you know, Republicans in Democratic-leaning districts. There are Democrats in Republican-leaning districts. There are third-party voters in almost every district. But if you are not in the voting block that is the majority in your district, well, you really don't get much of a say, much of a useful say, in who represents you.
Well, of course, one of the tricks there is if everything was at large, which is obviously one extreme, then minorities would probably never have representation. So it's important to have districts on one level. You know, maybe the best outcome is something similar to the Houston City Council system, where you have a mixture of at-large and regional representation.
If everything was single seat at-large, I would agree with you. But if the Fair Representation Act, H.R. 4000, by having multi-member districts, it gives people the opportunity to say it combines this with ranked choice voting and other election reforms. So it's not the only, you know, election reform proposed, but it allows for, you know, there to be multiple seats. So there can be multiple winners of the election. So you can have, you know, the Democratic candidate, if you're in a Democratic-leaning district, the Democratic candidate wins first. But then you would have the runner-up Republican takes the second seat, and then, say, the Green or Libertarian candidate takes the third seat, and the one who didn't take the third seat doesn't get elected. So you get a slightly better... that's, you know, keeping the same voting system, you would still have better representation of, you know, those political minorities.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with your summation of that, but as you point out, it probably isn't out of committee. It hasn't come up before a full session. It hasn't been marked up yet. So anything can or won't happen.
And I'm probably not explaining it the best either. So
I think it's good that alternatives are being considered. However, I will point this out. It's already been established by the Supreme Court that states can allot their electoral votes any way they want.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things Republicans have in the past tried to do, and I don't know if it was more than one state, but I know that at least in one state it was really looked at hard by Republicans, is allocating electoral votes by congressional district.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, not only would they have disproportionate representation due to gerrymandering, but they would make sure that if they didn't allocate all of the electoral votes, if they seemed to do something Democratic like proportionality, the proportionality would be the same way they allocate state legislative seats, which is to say that you can have half the vote being Democratic, but three quarters of the legislature is Republican.
Mm.
So just, you know, everything can be rigged. Devil's in the details.
Sure. Everything can be rigged, but...
But it's good to think about the options.
Yeah. If you don't change stuff, you'll never know what works better.
That can cut both ways. But anyway, getting on to the next topic.
Mm-hmm.
This is something based on multiple personal experiences of mine, but something that occurred last week that kind of brought it front of mind. We all know that restaurants have been struggling. They've been trying to figure out new business models, how to cope with the fact that people aren't going out for the most part. So what a lot of restaurants have hit on is a delivery model. And they're now geared so that a significant fraction of the business they're doing, they are delivering. But in almost every case, they don't have their own delivery people. They have third-party deliveries. You know, so for some supermarkets, it may be Instacart. For some restaurants, it may be Postmates or whatever it happens to be. So more than once, but this week, I had an experience where I had a problem with the delivery.
Mm.
Apparently, they had trouble getting in the gate and they didn't have my phone number and all kinds of stuff. So I don't have anyone to call but the restaurant. Right. And the restaurant is telling me, well, you know, that's a third-party delivery service. We have no control over that. This is not the first time I've heard that. But now, like 8 months in, this needs to be a more seamless experience. And I think it's fair to start calling both the restaurants and the third-party delivery services to account on this. I don't know who they're going to use for delivery. In this particular case, it took me over an hour. I mean, I think they were an hour and a quarter late finally for the delivery. I finally figured out a way to contact the delivery driver. It wasn't obvious. The restaurant could have done this, perhaps. It needs to be a more seamless experience, and I think that it behooves the restaurants primarily, but also the third-party delivery services to make this experience better for the consumer. There is no longer, in my opinion, an excuse for a restaurant to say, well, you know, we made the food and handed it off. Nothing we can do now. That's just not an acceptable response anymore, 8 months into this experience.
Yeah, that reminds me of the time that I ordered... Can I say the name of the restaurant, the fast food chain?
I would rather you didn't.
Okay. I ordered food from a fast food chain, national chain, on their app. Mm. And I ordered delivery because they were offering free delivery.
Right.
And the delivery was handled by another third-party food delivery service. And I paid for my order. And I, you know, turned on the light in the hallway and sat there and waited. And 30 minutes past the estimated delivery date went by, and it said the guy was still in transit. And then about an hour later, it said the food had been delivered. And when I checked to see I hadn't gotten it. And when I checked to see on the map where they had delivered the food, they had delivered it to the parking lot of a closed down Carl's Jr. near my house. Not even near my house, like miles away, 10 miles away from my house. I have no idea how that happened. And I had nobody I could like call, or I tried calling the driver. They gave me a phone number, but he never picked up. And so I eventually had to, you know, email the delivery service and be like, hey, this happened. And it took like, you know, a couple business days before they eventually gave me a refund. But yeah, like there are definitely issues still with these food delivery services, and having somebody ready to talk to, somebody who you know is going to pick up the phone,
somebody who can take responsibility and try to resolve the issue,
is really important for customer service and these sorts of things.
Now, so, I'll tell you, in this particular situation, they had texted me an app link so that I could click on a site, and it was really kind of adorable in a way. I could see this little car wending its way up the 610 loop and exiting off the loop and coming toward my gate. And apparently was at my gate. Now, it's not necessarily intuitive operating my gate if you're not, like, on the phone with me.
Mm-hmm.
But the instructions are there.
Yeah.
And after – and I got a text that the delivery person is at the gate. Please come to the gate.
Right.
But, of course, you know, the point of delivery isn't that I go and meet the delivery driver somewhere. The point of delivery is they bring me the delivery.
Right.
So I was waiting for a phone call, never got a phone call. After a while, I watched this cute little avatar back out of the driveway from the gate and then began meandering all over the area, like south of the loop, east of my street, north of 610, around this other street, stop for a while, go some more. And I'm trying to figure out, what is this person doing?
Yeah.
I mean, literally... the driver was a she. She could have, and I mentioned this to her, but she was really, really not a customer relations person, I will just say in summation. She could have just backed out of the drive. It's a two-lane blacktop road. She could have backed to the shoulder across the street. There's plenty of space for her. Could have simply, if all else failed, waited for someone to come into the subdivision, which periodically happens.
Yeah.
I mean, if all else failed... Why was she meandering around the neighborhood? Why was that a superior solution? I mean, it was a mystery to me. And the restaurant couldn't do anything for me.
Yeah.
And the manager at the restaurant couldn't do anything for me. And the best I got was, well, you know, we'll have to call corporate and, you know, discuss the issue with them.
Uh-huh.
By the time I got the food, I tried calling the restaurant to sort of do a final follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
And they were closed, and there was no one to talk to. So I finally had to press the extension for the catering manager and left a message for the catering manager and never did get a call back from anyone at the restaurant. So I don't want to single out this restaurant. This is sort of an ongoing situation that over time, one way or another, I'm sure will resolve. But this is how bad it's gotten.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's worth saying – I don't put a whole lot of blame on the drivers or even the restaurant themselves for these delivery snafus. I think the problem is largely the technology. And when, you know, the technology is not set up to anticipate issues like an inaccurate delivery location or an unexpected obstacle that the driver needs to contact the customer to deal with.
Well, I mean, app-wise, I know. I am absolutely certain I must have given my cell phone number in because I ordered online.
Right.
There's just no way that that app would complete without my phone number. I mean, they just don't.
Right, right.
So the restaurant must have gotten my phone number. And maybe it didn't transfer to the delivery person's paperwork.
Possibly.
Or maybe they didn't know where to find it.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah.
Now, I will say this. In the course of our acrimonious discussions, at one point, she seemed to indicate that the address, either the address she had or the address she thought she had, it was not my address.
Mm.
It was like instead of a 6, she was reading an 8.
Right.
So, you know, I think that to some extent this was very idiosyncratic to this particular driver, which having had the interpersonal experience with her, I have to say was horrible. I've been in customer contact jobs almost all my life, and this should have been an instant termination. Just saying. And this is not something I normally will say about employees. I don't want to be responsible for someone getting fired. This person needed to be fired. I don't say that lightly. This was a really bad interaction.
I hope she's not listening.
I hope she is. I hope she is. She'll know who she is. In any case, it's time for a break.
Yeah.
We've been going on. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM with my co-host Andrew Ferguson. You can follow all the stuff we talk about for the most part. I have links to all the stories I reference when I cite a story at thinkwingradio.com. You can go to the blog post for each individual show. I have this stuff literally going back to 2010. It's all loaded into the website. You can also communicate with me or follow me on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio, on Facebook, ThinkWing Radio with Mike Koenig. And, of course, you can follow KPFT at kpft.org. And you can see the goings-on of the station, events that are planned, in many cases virtual. You can go to the archives at archives.kpft.org and listen to shows that you may have missed. In some cases, you can download the shows. I think most shows are on there for up to eight weeks, I believe, up to 60 days, some 30, some less. You can also podcast a lot of shows. You can podcast this show. You can go to your podcast app and look for Think Wing Radio, and I don't know how they do it, but you can podcast it. Okay, so the next story is a local story and for me has a certain resonance. I believe this is from Click2 Houston. By the way, Andrew, you questioned why they call it Click2 Houston.
Yes.
And I didn't have an answer for you last week, but then I remembered something since then. They used to call themselves, when I first came to Houston, they used to call it Big2 News.
Huh. Okay.
So that's a thing that was for many years, and now I guess they don't do that, but that's probably where Click2 Houston came from.
Okay, all right.
So, old person memory. In any case, a driver was killed after his vehicle was T-boned by an HPD patrol unit responding to a call. This innocent driver was turning from a gas station onto a road and was hit broadside by an HPD patrol unit. The unit was responding to a call, was not running siren, was not running lights. The driver of the vehicle, the civilian, died ultimately at the hospital or was pronounced at the hospital. The reason this resonated with me is pretty much the exact same thing happened to a couple of scientists from the Baylor College of Medicine, I think maybe 10 years ago. They lived in an apartment or a condo off like Spanish Trail. They had left work. They were turning in to their parking lot and a police car speeding to a call, no lights, no siren, broadsided them at a high rate of speed. The woman was in the hospital for quite a while. The man died. So it's not like this is unprecedented. Mm. Now, I can understand not running a siren if you don't want to alert a perpetrator that you're on your way. I think that there are complications with without siren. Absolutely no excuse for not running with lights.
Mm.
No excuse. At night, if you are in a police car speeding, when there are headlights coming toward me, when you get to a high rate of speed, it's very, very hard to gauge speed.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the reasons you have speed limits on roads where people can turn, is because at a certain point, you cannot gauge a speed. So you can't, like, estimate a time in your head.
Right.
All these two people saw, the two people I knew, all they saw was headlights coming toward them. They had no way of evaluating the high rate of speed this car was moving at. And at least if there had been lights flashing, they'd probably be alive. Both of them would probably be alive today.
Hmm.
So that's why I picked out this story as something local that I thought had greater than normal resonance for me.
Hmm.
Next story is from the Texas Tribune. As the Trump campaign challenges election results, El Paso has a different question. Where is our money? El Paso is one of several Texas cities facing budget shortfalls because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And they had a Trump rally that he still owes, or his campaign, let's say to be specific, technical, still owes them money. In February 2019, there was a campaign. It cost the city $470,000. Since then, because it's gone unpaid, they've added an additional $99,000 in late fees. So now you're over half a million, almost two-thirds. The city considered and then decided against suing the campaign. You got this whole tricky thing about a sitting president. This is not the only city that he has, that his campaign, I'm doing air quotes, that his campaign has stiffed. So I think that there is probably several million dollars in municipal costs, at the very least municipal. There may have been some state or county assistance in various places. But there's several million dollars that the campaign is in arrears that they just don't pay, which is really very typical of Donald Trump. I mean, his mantra is kind of don't pay a bill if you don't have to, contest everything. In his book, The Art of the Deal, he bragged about the contractors and suppliers that either he stiffed them or he found a reason to discount their price, or at a certain point decided, I've paid you enough, I don't need to pay you anymore. And then, of course, what are you going to do? You're going to sue Donald Trump? I mean, this is kind of the modus operandi.
Mm, yeah. For clarity's sake, this is a campaign rally in El Paso that cost the city in security and other related expenses.
Right, in case, cleanup and whatever.
Right. In case you wonder, how did a campaign cost the city money? It's a campaign rally.
Whenever there's an event, whenever there's a public event, there are fees that must be paid.
Right.
Permits as well as, you know, for most other people, most other organizations, there would be a deposit.
Yeah.
I guess in this case, they figured, you know, campaign.
Mm.
Well, that was a mistake. Mm. What's amazing to me is the number of cities that continued hosting them without a deposit, knowing that the previous cities had never been paid. That's kind of the amazing thing to me.
Well, I mean, that's a question. I mean, did the other cities know, and was there no deposit required?
Well, the first couple of cities, it's like, okay, you know, maybe, maybe not. But after you have like two or three municipalities and mayors talk and governors talk and county judges and county managers talk, it's like, you know, the first time, shame on me. The fifth, 10th, 15th time, man, that's really shame on me.
Hmm.
Okay. So, I mean, on the one hand, it's pathetic that the campaign does this. On the other hand, there is the question of why did cities continue hosting them? So there's that. Hmm. Okay. Early break. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 FM, Houston, KPFT Houston. KPFT.org is how you learn about the station. It's how you can contribute to the station. It's how you can donate to help support the station. We are 100% dependent on financial support from the community. So, you know, whether it's a couple of dollars or a membership, I think you can become a member for $25, or if you can contribute more, whatever you can afford, whenever you can afford it, it's greatly appreciated. KPFT really needs your support to stay on the air, as does this show. Okay, next story, also from the Texas Tribune. Texans were rescued by the U.S. government after getting stranded in Peru. Now the bills are arriving. So the essence of this story, I've cited a lot, but I'm just going to kind of break it down. When the U.S. government helps its citizens leave a place of danger, in this case, they were sort of trapped in Peru because of COVID-19. Usually, they do charge you something, but the law, from what I understand of the article, stipulates that it shouldn't be any more than it would reasonably cost in normal times in order to leave a place, you know, with
right.
lodging or whatever.
Right.
Well, in this particular case, the U.S. government saw fit to charge each person $1,300 for the flight. In other words, any other expenses around this evacuation were already borne by the citizens.
Mm.
And normally a flight is a few hundred dollars. And the government is charging $1,300 for a one-way fare, and it's not even like business class.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they were packed into these chartered aircraft.
Mm.
So you have people that can't necessarily afford that kind of money, can't afford it on the timeline that the government requires it, maybe shouldn't have to be charged that much, maybe a quarter the amount. And even not counting the airfare, these people already, aside from the danger and trauma of the experience, laid out a considerable amount in most cases of out-of-pocket expenses. So
yeah.
This is, again, I think this is an example of the Trump regime. This is how their policies treat American citizens. If you remember, at the beginning of COVID-19, we had American citizens on cruise ships, and the president didn't want them to come into the country under any circumstances because that would increase the number of people with COVID.
Mm.
So this is the philosophy that we're living under right now, and hopefully soon won't be.
It's made worse by the fact that the people in Peru, the excerpt of the article mentions, which you can find on our blog post at thinkwingradio.com, they had to pay for their own lodgings, extend those lodgings past the point where they were prepared to pay for them, and all while they tried to get in contact with the embassy, which wasn't responding to them. So they've
and
already...
And they had to figure out how to get to the airport to make the flight out.
Yeah. They
In the article, didn't it say that some people actually walked to the airport?
I didn't see that, but I can believe it. I mean, this was a military lockdown of the country to contain COVID-19.
So the article has many pictures of Peruvian troops in the streets.
Right. So it's not like it was for a bad reason, right, to stop COVID-19. But, you know, this was a very stressful situation. People were already out of pocket for expenses that they weren't anticipating. And now they're getting slapped with a $1,300 bill that is...
About four times what should be a reasonable cost.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. The next story is interesting because of the discussion that Andrew and I had before the show about this. So I'm going to discuss something about... I'm going to go down some information about the story. Then Andrew is going to do his response.
Mm-hmm.
The story is from the LA Times. Portland's anarchists say they support racial justice. Black activists want nothing to do with them. So the story begins that the day after President-elect Joe Biden delivered his victory speech, a clandestine Twitter account summoned, which I've deleted the name, but it's in the article, summoned Portland anarchists calling for black garb and vigilance to evade police for a protest, quote, in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. 50 or so people showed up, nearly all of them white. The call to action had declared no masters, leaders in the parlance of 19th century European anarchists, but the crowd huddled around one young man as he lambasted liberals for celebrating the defeat of Trump while capitalism and the political system remained entrenched. Word spread through the group that that the target would be the local headquarters of the Democratic Party. The anarchists marched into the upscale neighborhood. For months, Portland has been a significant face of Black Lives Matter, in part because of the national attention that self-described anarchists brought to nightly protests. They set fires. This is now previously. They set fires, launched fireworks at authorities, spat in police faces to draw them into violent confrontation that made headlines. Black activists and community leaders, according to the article, who generally view the defeat of Trump as an opportunity for change within the system, said the anarchists are hijacking the movement and undermining the push for racial justice by continuing to commit violence. According to Mingus Maps, a black resident who won a seat on the Portland City Council, when people set fire to a building, it really does not liberate me one bit, he said. It does the opposite. It fuels the political culture that makes racism possible. The former political science professor who peacefully participated in demonstrations plans to advocate for police reform beyond budget cuts passed by the council. The anarchists believe working within the system is futile and say the political order and capitalist economy must be torn down. Distrusting the media, all refuse to give their names, but pamphlets distributed at a recent rally outline their far-left philosophies. Abolish All Mayors, the title of one booklet, advocates the complete democratization and community control of all city bureaus and the abolition of police. Why We Break Windows advocates an end to private property. This is another pamphlet. Shop windows represent segregation, it says. To smash a shop window is to contest all the boundaries that cut through society, black and white, rich and poor, included and excluded. In some ways, the anarchists have served the Black Lives Matter movement in Portland, according to the article, creating a spectacle that drew attention to the cause of racial justice after the death of George Floyd. But the violence has also caused problems for Black Lives Matter. In June, black community leaders denounced an arson attack by protesters on a building that houses a police station and black-owned businesses on Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. When, according to Ron Herndon, a longtime black activist, when I hear about somebody burning something down, I think about that as an act that's always been used against black people. You're not helping us. So I picked the story because I think that it's supported by prior reporting, by interviews I have seen and read, by videos I have seen that seem to support a lot of what the article contends. Andrew has a different feeling, so I'll let him speak for himself.
I do. I think I should start by saying I am an anarchist sympathetic leftist. And so, you know, there is going to be some bias from me, of course. But I prepared my issues with this article ahead of time. I'm going to be talking about the entire article, not just what's on the blog post, which you can find at thinkwingradio.com. You can find the link to the entire article there. I recommend you read the entire thing and judge for yourself. I think there's significant bias present in this article. The author, Richard Reed, describes events in ways that attempt to make the anarchists look hypocritical, presenting one person at the protest who spoke to the crowd as a leader of the event and asserting that that contradicts anarchism's opposition to hierarchy. And unreasonable, claiming without a source that the anarchists did not care about counting all votes in the presidential election, and claiming that they targeted a city council member's home without a clear goal, but later stating in the article that the targeted council member voted against police budget cuts, which is a common policy goal of many racial justice groups around the nation. The article features no one-on-one quotes from anarchists at the event, but instead quotes people whom Mr. Reed describes as, quote, black activists and community leaders. This is city council members, professors, investment managers, nonprofit directors, and the vice chair of the County Democratic Party. These are people who are involved with the system that anarchism opposes, and so it's logical to conclude that they would oppose anarchism. But the anarchists are given no opportunity in the article to defend their actions and beliefs, and no black anarchists are included, resulting in the article portraying black people as all holding the same political views. I also cannot verify some of the assertions made in the article. For example, I cannot find any record or archive of the tweet that the author claims organized the protest. The author makes claims about the racial makeup of the anarchists at the event that are not sourced and, in my opinion, cannot be verified by the images in the article. The author recalls specific incidents of anarchists provoking police, but sources these claims with a link to the Portland Police's general protest information page instead of any evidence about these specific incidents. One source cited in the article is Reason.com, which is a known right-leaning news source. And the article quotes the vice chair of the County Democratic Party mentioned earlier as also the head of Portland's Black Lives Matter chapter, when I could find no evidence of an official Black Lives Matter chapter in Portland. I think that this article has some serious flaws. I think it has some serious bias, and I don't think it is a responsibly done piece of reporting. I could defend the anarchists' actions and beliefs in general, but I think that that is what I, you know, just talked about is a better way to look at this specific article and this specific event.
Okay. My opinion is that this article reflects enough prior reporting that I think it's plausible, at the very least. And you don't, so I think there
yeah.
we are.
I think it contradicts some on-the-ground reporting enough to make it make its plausibility questionable. So,
well, the information is out there for anyone who cares to research and
sure.
make up their own mind.
Sure.
Okay. It seems like just yesterday that we were talking about the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan and Nagorno-Karabakh, and now we're talking about Ethiopia and Eritrea and, you know, maybe Sudan and civil war. So the article's from TheGuardian.com. Secret UN report reveals fears of long and bitter war in Ethiopia. Now, I've taken some excerpts that address specifically that headline. There's a lot more in the article. The UN, in more than a dozen interviews with aid workers from other international organizations, give the most comprehensive overview so far of the fighting in Ethiopia, and will deepen international concerns that the two-week-old conflict threatens to become a long and brutal battle, destabilizing one of Africa's most fragile regions. Keep in mind, Ethiopia also borders Somalia, so there have been those issues. The UN assessment, interviews, and other international aid organization analyses all suggest any expectation of a rapid and decisive victory is optimistic, and resistance is likely to stiffen as Tigray troops fall back into mountains east of Mekelle. Tigray is a province in northwestern Ethiopia, and apparently the Tigrayans used to have what many Ethiopians considered an unreasonable amount of sway over national policy and governing, and now they feel like their advantage has been taken away because of a new government structure, and they have weaponry. So you could look at this as the central government perhaps putting down a local uprising or insurgency, or you can look at it as what could be the beginning of a civil war. Eritrea used to be part of Ethiopia. There was a two-year civil war. Eritrea became an independent nation. They don't like the Tigrayans either. So this can get really messy really fast. There's one more bit I want to read. Ethiopia has long been a linchpin of U.S. policy in the fragile East African region. So far, Washington has supported the current Ethiopian leader, Abiy, I think is how it's pronounced. Tigor Nagy, U.S. Assistant Secretary of African Affairs, told reporters, "This is not two sovereign states fighting. This is a faction of the government running a region that has decided to undertake hostilities against the central government, and it has not had the effect they thought they were going to get." Emphasizing this is a much longer article with
right.
much more background. So it might be, if you're interested in this kind of international news, it might be worth your while to go to the article, which is at thinkwingradio.com.
Right.
Just mentioning.
This is like we've seen with what happened in Nagorno-Karabakh. These kinds of conflicts can progress very rapidly. Who knows what state it's going to be in by the time we speak to you again next week. but it's one to watch, it's one to look into, and it's one to, you know, keep aware of the political ramifications of.
Well, you know, there's an old saying, I keep hearing it, I don't know if it is in fact a Chinese curse, but may you live through interesting times.
Mm.
Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM with my co-host Andrew Ferguson. You can follow KPFT at kpft.org. You can download shows from the archive. You can listen to shows you've missed. And you can use your podcasting app to podcast shows on KPFT, including Think Wing Radio. Mm. Andrew, you actually have some contact information for people who might want to follow or contact you.
Yeah, if you can't get enough of our show at thinkwingradio.com, you can follow me on my personal social media. I'm at DominateEYE on Twitter, and spelled the same, DominateI.tumblr.com.
Okay. And, of course, KPFT can always use your support. You can click on the donate link at kpft.org. We rely on our listeners 100%. Mm. And, you know, not only in terms of whatever you can contribute, whenever you can contribute it, word of mouth helps too. Tell your friends, tell people you chat with. If you like a show, this one or some other show on KPFT, because there are over 100, let people know, you know, spread the word. We can always use more ears.
Mm.
Okay. You know, last week we kind of talked about forward-looking prospects,
right?
Social, societal change going forward from COVID, because of COVID. One of the things we talked about was mass transit, cross-country rail, various people moving from urban areas to smaller towns, perhaps smaller cities, or in some cases, I was reading an article before we went on the air about a young English woman who just decided, you know, she was visiting Bermuda and just decided to stay there. And that's where she works from. So this particular story is from the Financial Times via the LA Times. New York and the Crisis in Mass Transit Systems is the name of the article. The Long Island Railroad was once known as the route of the dashing commuter. As chief executive of the New York region's public transportation system, Patrick Foy's vinyl seat provides a stark view of the effects of the coronavirus. The parking lots at Port Washington are empty. The Long Island Railroad's rail cars are carrying a quarter of their normal daily load of more than 300,000 passengers. Office workers no longer dash, they Zoom. A collapse in fare and tax revenue has opened a $12 billion hole in the Transit Authority's budget. Without more aid from Congress, Foy may furlough 8,000 employees, eliminate billions of dollars of planned capital spending, and gut service on New York's subways, buses, and railways, including the Long Island Railroad. The pandemic is setting in motion structural changes in how employees do their jobs, with profound implications for urban settlement, transport networks, and energy use. Such a scenario could seriously weaken the finances of public transit that underpin great cities. No other mode of transportation can efficiently deliver millions of workers into dense central business districts. We would have to think about right-sizing service and taking steps to reduce costs to get it commensurate with long-term decline, Foy said. Suburban railways lost the most trade as white-collar workers and students now work remotely. Buses regained about half the passengers they had before COVID, reflecting demand from those with fewer options. The transit-dependent tend to have lower incomes, are more often people of color, and include some of the essential workers keeping hospitals, kitchens, and warehouses open during the pandemic. As more affluent office workers desert transit, they may be less willing to see taxes support it. Car traffic is now back to about 80% of pre-pandemic volume. Consider the fact that people see cars as being sort of a safer health bubble than mass transit is.
Mm.
James Hughes from Rutgers University said, "This is now a watershed moment in the world of work. The coronavirus shock may have exposed an outmoded white-collar workplace structure. Work is now being recognized as much more of an activity than a place. Employers are making decisions that will have lasting effects on commuting trips. J.P. Morgan Chase's HQ rises just north of Manhattan's Grand Central Terminal. The financial giant's corporate and investment bank will now be rotating its more than 60,000 employees in and out of offices across the world. Some companies are exiting the city completely. Kevin Crum's tech recruitment company recently signed a 10-year office lease adjacent to a section of the Chicago Loop. Crum said, "You don't have to be within a commutable proximity. I feel like that's a big shift. I feel like this whole talent, geography, labor cost arbitrage is underway." Said Mitchell Ross, director of the Rudin Center for Transportation at NYU, "The transit system is going to have to adapt to the modern workforce." So, massive changes, unpredictable changes, unpredictable consequences. It's, you know, people are going to look back on this as a pivotal point in, of course, from the U.S. standpoint, U.S. history, but as a pivotal point in world history. The article makes reference to other cities in Europe that have also had to rethink their mass transit and how they fund it and how they route it and how much they run it.
This
is a big deal. And when they talk about exiting the city completely, this sort of goes back to the comments that we made last week, which is you may find small towns being reinvigorated when people that maybe either don't want to be in a city life or can't afford to find a dwelling in the city, maybe they find a smaller town, 10,000, 50,000 people more to their liking. And if they can work remotely and maybe commute in once a week by car or rail to the central city for their office, those are things I think we'll be seeing. And you know, money is fungible, whether it's spent here or someplace else. People will spend money. The question is where and how. And that'll have big economic consequences going forward.
I think, I mean, it's a shame that, I think it's a shame that COVID-19 could result in defunding of mass transit and this sort of thing, because I generally see mass transit as a public good, a form of transport superior to cars, even, certainly for their environmental impact and efficiency. But I don't know how mass transit can really fight this, except, you know, unless cars get redesigned to be... this is an idea from a piece of zombie apocalypse fiction I read once about actually living in a world that has rebuilt post-apocalypse and has tried to kind of resume business as usual. Coaches in this world, which I cannot remember the name of the book series, I'm terribly sorry. Coaches, as in, you know, long bus rides in this world, they separate their seats in twos, and they have the ability at any time to put down some sort of material, some sort of isolating barrier around a section of two seats, so that if somebody turns during a journey, you know, the system detects that, puts the barrier down, and the only person at risk is the person who was sitting next to them, which is not ideal, but is better than everybody on the bus being at risk. So I guess you could maybe do something like having rows of seats be pods. You know, you have hand sanitizer available frequently throughout the car, and, you know, there's little, you know, windows and this obviously isn't suitable for retrofitting, I don't think. But for new designs of public transit vehicles, maybe, you know, something that helps isolate people and prevent the spread of communicable diseases.
I can't say no. I mean, obviously, if people get sufficiently neurotic about viruses, which wouldn't be entirely a bad thing. More hand washing is good. But let's say if there's sort of a middle ground, obviously some of the adaptations would be shorter trains, fewer cars, less frequent service, better focusing on peak periods. And like in some cities, they turn off the mass transit at midnight. So, you know, you get a taxi or whatever. I ran across an article recently, I don't remember where, that they referenced what they called roughly the commoditizing of cars, where essentially you would have shared vehicles. Most people would not own a car. They could call for a car by an app. get into the car, run their errands, so you would have fewer cars used more efficiently.
Right.
Now, I have to say, getting into the zombie apocalypse, okay, I still watch Walking Dead and spinoffs.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many things they don't really discuss that I consider so central to that world. For example, you really can't spend the night sleeping with somebody anymore. They can die in their sleep and kill you.
Yeah.
So you like have to be intimate when you're intimate, but make sure you're awake for it because you need to go into another room before you actually go to sleep.
Yeah.
They don't talk about the fact that everyone has to sleep with their doors closed because even toddlers can die, God forbid, in their sleep and become zombie toddlers and wander out and kill mom and dad.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so much they don't. They've never really talked about why you can be spat on or you can get blood and various other bodily fluids from zombies and not turn into a zombie, but somehow being scratched or bitten will do it.
Yeah.
I still don't get that.
Mm.
Now, this is not exactly the kind of stuff we talk about on this show, but it's not unprecedented. I have talked about Walking Dead before.
Uh-huh.
So these are just things that make you go, hmm.
Hmm.
All right, I guess you don't have anything else to talk about from Zombieland.
No, I don't. But that was a very entertaining discussion, and, you know, we all need a little diversion every now and then. So
a little zombie worlding.
Yeah.
So, speaking of brains, there's an article from TheGuardian.com. This is actually from October 6th. Air pollution particles in young brains linked to Alzheimer's damage. If discovery is confirmed, it will have global implications as 90% of people breathe dirty air. So the article goes, tiny air pollution particles have been revealed in the brain stems of young people and are intimately associated with molecular damage linked to Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. If the discovery is confirmed by future research, it would have worldwide implications because 90% of the population in the world lived with unsafe air. Medical experts are cautious about the findings, said that while the nanoparticles are a likely cause of the damage, whether this leads to disease later in life remains to be seen. And there's all kinds of stuff about Alzheimer's disease that it turns out they don't know, but maybe are discovering. That's just an aside. There is already good statistical evidence that higher exposure to air pollution increases rates of neurodegenerative diseases, but the significance of the new study is that it shows a possible physical mechanism by which the damage is done. The causes of neurodegenerative disease are complex and not fully understood. There's definitely going to be genetic factors and highly likely to be other neurotoxicants. So, again, depending on the future of commuting, traveling, mass transit, all things are up in the air.
Yeah.
Okay. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson. He's also my indispensable editor and occasional political foil. We'll look forward to speaking to you, not seeing you technically, next week. I hope you've enjoyed the show, found it interesting, and hope you'll be listening next Monday. Take care.
See you later, folks.
Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late. We should be giving.
If you have friends in other cities who wish they had access to some of the great programming you hear on this station and the Pacifica Radio Network, we have a website for you.
PacificaNetwork.org gives community radio stations like this one complete information on how to become a Pacifica affiliate and information for listeners looking for community radio stations that air Pacifica programming.
With the launch of PacificaNetwork.org, Pacifica Radio is bringing together frequently requested items regarding Pacifica as a network.
Nearly 100 radio stations.
From Carbondale, Colorado to Benwood, West Virginia.
From Bend, Oregon to Hobbs Ferry, New York.
From Moscow, Idaho to Chicago, Illinois.
Have all made a statement by linking up and carrying Pacifica radio programming.
So tell your far-flung friends about PacificaNetwork.org to connect communities.
This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.